From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Just before last year's election, a survey found that viewers of Comedy Central's Daily Show were better informed about politics than people who watch network news every day. On today's Fresh Air, Daily Show host Jon Stewart tells us how he blends facts and satire to produce a show that makes you laugh and makes you think. There's a new DVD set of The Daily Show's Indecision 2004. Also, Carole King tells us about writing some of the most memorable songs of her generation. She has a new live album called The Living Room Tour. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Hustle and Flow, about a Memphis rapper trying to make it to the big time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. In 6 years as host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, my guest Jon Stewart's quick wit and biting satire have taken the once obscure fake news show and made it an influential voice in American humor and politics. His guests now include top celebrities, politicians, and writers, and The Daily Show is often quoted in mainstream political coverage. The program won a Peabody Award in 2000 for campaign coverage and has won several Emmys. A new collection of The Daily Show's coverage of the 2004 presidential campaign, Indecision 2004, has just been released on DVD. And last year, Stewart and The Daily Show came out with a book called America the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. It's still in the top 10 in the New York Times hardback nonfiction bestseller list. Stewart shortened his name from John Stewart Leibowitz because he said it sounded too Hollywood. Stewart started doing stand-up in the mid-80s, got a show on MTV and an HBO special, and had parts in several movies before joining The Daily Show in 1999. I spoke to John Stewart last year. Let's begin with something from The Daily Show. This is from the program that aired the day after President Bush announced the nomination of John Roberts to the Supreme Court. They've just played a clip in which CNN's Robert Novak insisted that Justice Rehnquist's retirement was imminent.
When it comes to the vacancy left by Sandra Day O'Connor, the media has shown restraint. And when word of an imminent announcement for her replacement filtered through yesterday, journalists were determined not to make the same mistake.
Everyone in Washington outside of the White House, some even saying they had been told by people inside the White House today that it would be Judge Edith Brown Clement.
But the focus is on one name in particular.
The name is Edith Brown Clement.
The name that is on everybody's lips today is Judge Edith Clement.
We've learned that the president met with Edith Clement.
Here's the thing. Apparently, not only are they always wrong, they're always wrong and they put it on tape. Apparently, the only time the press gets it right is when the White House illegally leaks it to them. Now, Edith Clement was not President Bush's choice. Last night, he unveiled his pick with his usual mastery of the rhetorically obvious.
When a president chooses a justice, he's placing in human hands the authority and majesty of the law.
So you're going with a human, are you? Excellent.
Well, John Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Do you have as much fun doing that show as it looks like you're having?
No.
No.
Let me explain something. Our entire day is focused on taking the unfun we have, making it, and turning it into fun when it gets on the air. Because we function actually very similarly probably to a news show in that we have sort of an editorial meeting in the morning. It's a really structured day. We actually do have a very good time doing it, but... It's sort of relentless, and it's a lot of the structure of our day is a lot more rigid, I think, than people would imagine.
You start by reading the New York Times, The Economist, everything, watching a million news clips?
No, we get most of our news from the tickers on the top of cabs. So it starts from that. Our day usually starts with sports scores.
Building it from the ground up, right.
Exactly. We normally... You know, the papers are not, it's not like we come in at 8:30 and start reading the paper and go, ooh, this story's interesting. I mean, we're working, the beautiful thing about faking a news show is the topicality is delayed. And the truth is, it helps us more to have saturation of a news story because then everybody's very familiar with the parameters of it. So we generally are working a day or two ahead.
Yeah, you got
at least at our best.
You got a chance to do the Howard Dean scream after everybody had already heard it.
Yes, although we didn't do it, I think, as much as what you would imagine the other news organizations. Unfortunately for us, things that are absurd on its face value, things that are funny don't really help us as much as, you know, Fabio on a roller coaster getting hit in the face with a bird doesn't really help us as much as Alawi speaking to a joint session of Congress.
Telling us that corruption is leaving his country, right.
Yes, exactly. So it's... Things that are inherently amusing are not as interesting to us.
How much of it do you write? How much of it do your writers come up with?
I write the entire program. What I like to do is come in, write the entire program, and treat my staff to hot stone massages.
That's boy.
It's just how I like to work. Yeah. I'll come in around 7, have half a grapefruit, do some jazzercise, and then just get to writing.
God, you are as decent a man as we thought.
Oh, it's absolutely unbelievable. No, we have an unbelievable staff of writers, and Ben Carlin, the executive producer, DJ Javerbaum, who's the head writer, and then all the writers, the correspondents. I mean, for me, I can literally show up at 5 pretty drunk, and as long as the show is spelled out phonetically on the prompter, you know, I'll do okay. Just have to face the right direction. Well, I sort of function as, in some respects, in the same way you would imagine the anchor functions as a managing editor type.
Was there a point at which, you know, in recent years, you suddenly realized that all of the A-list celebrities and newsmakers wanted to be on the show? I mean, you've had an incredible run of people coming onto the show.
We find that the biggest stars, the most powerful people, want desperately to be on the most obscure cable channel they can find. It's just something that they want. It gives them a sense of adventure. We're like Outward Bound. You know, to find our show, you have to go past Spanish people playing soccer. It's right. Not something that, you know, you just fall upon.
I want to talk a bit about the celebrity interview thing you've done. And we've all got right, a clip here of a big, big celebrity. This was former President Bill Clinton. And I wondered if you were at all nervous about meeting him, since you guys were so naturally kind of even-handed and tasteful during the Lewinsky scandal.
I was not in any way. You know, I actually got there pretty much at the back end, if you pardon the expression, of the Lewinsky scandal. So I was not as responsible for the prevalence right. of jokes. But, I mean, the truth is, right. at a certain point, I would imagine he's kind of numb to sexual innuendo and everything else. So I don't imagine that, you know, if he were to avoid contact with all those who made Lewinsky jokes, I don't imagine he would be going out very often.
Right. All right, well, let's hear this. And I'll just say for our audience that this is the beginning of the Clinton interview, and it's followed a set in which you've sort of had some fun with the Swiftboat veterans attacking John Kerry's war record. This is John Stewart interviewing former President Bill Clinton.
Thank you for coming. Nice to see you.
I'm glad to see you.
Thank you so much for coming on the program.
I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you did that riff on the military attack on Kerry, too.
That was a rough one, wasn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, they did the same thing to McCain in 2000.
Same group, am I right?
The same group.
Nice kids.
Yeah. In support of the same crowd, I might point out.
Right. Who had nothing to do with it. No.
They also pointed out they had a calling operation in South Carolina in the primary in 2000, talking about how John McCain had a black baby, and they didn't want the white voters to forget it.
Right. They actually meant Strom Thurmond. It's just they had the wrong name.
That's right. They did.
That's John Stewart speaking with Bill Clinton. You know, that line is still funny to me. And when I saw it live, I thought there's no way that he got an ex-president to set him up for that line.
No, Bill and I actually, we call each other sort of at night, you know, and I said to him, what are you going to wear? And he said, what are you going to wear? And then we'd sort of go over our riffs, kind of Abbott and Costello-y.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of TV interview shows, I mean, people do kind of, there's some planning going on between producers. We'll talk about this, you talk about that, so you have a chance to prep.
Right.
I mean, you just snapped that line off, like, and it made me think of the pressure of you there with 4 or 5 minutes with a celebrity. And, you know, in most interview programs, there's a lot of ways to do a good interview. The guest can say something new, they can say something revealing about themselves, or they can be funny.
Right.
But this is Comedy Central, and you've got to give us a laugh every 45 seconds. Is that pressure?
It would be pressure if that weren't the only thing I was good at. You know, if the pressure was to come up with actually something insightful and intellectually stimulating and emotionally honest, yeah, that would be pressure. But if the concept is to come up with a wisecrack every 45 seconds, it's really the only thing that I've been trained for. So in some respects, it's not pressure. The pressure is when the expectation is that something other than that is going to occur, and that's probably when my lack of professionalism shows more openly than during things like that when I'm doing wisecracks.
Well, I think you're selling yourself a little short there, and we're going to get
I'll do this short selling here, young man.
All right. Lowered expectations is part of the political game.
That's exactly right.
But I guess the other thing I wanted to ask is, you've got a new baby at home, born in July.
What? Oh, my God, I've got to go. Wait, how often do you have to feed those?
No, you do have a wife, Tracy, and I imagine you have some help.
Yes.
But are there times you come
in? What else are you imagining about our lives? I imagine you have a fountain made of marble, and I imagine the walls are gilded in gold.
No,
Yeah, I'm thinking like an illegal immigrant there helping out around the house or something. I don't know.
Now, why does it have to be illegal?
You're a celebrity.
All right.
But I wonder if you come in sleep deprived sometimes, and that makes it a little tougher to, I don't know, to do what you do.
I think doing what we do actually is enhanced by a certain sleep deprivation, because it's the part of your brain that you're not really in touch with until something's desperately wrong. It is relentless. But the nice part about working with a very talented group of people is, you know, on a daily basis, not everybody's bringing their A game every day, but there's always somebody there to sort of bring a little bit of inspiration or a little bit of something else. I consider one of my better talents to be recognizing a good idea when I hear it. Mm-hmm. One of the most important things to be able to do in a show like this that is so relentless in terms of its production schedule is to be able to recognize, you know, when your idea isn't it and when someone else has it, and be able to quickly run with that.
Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview last year with Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. The show's coverage of last year's presidential campaign, Indecision 2004, has just been released on DVD. The Columbia Journalism Review, one of the most respected journalism publications in the country, had a website in which they asked their readers to poll those who were doing the best at covering the presidential campaign. You came in fourth. Well above people in the New York Times and other better-known publications.
Yes. Now, that is either a terrible statement about the state of news in our country or the state of comedy on our program. I'm not sure which. Probably both.
All right. Well, I want to play a clip that might give us a little insight into why someone might mistake you for a journalist. And this is you interviewing former Republican Congressman Henry Bonilla. And I believe this was during the time of Democratic National Convention. And he was a part of the Republicans' rapid response team. So let's listen to Jon Stewart interviewing former Republican Congressman Henry Bonilla.
But so I turn on the TV and they say, he's the first most liberal senator, John Edwards is the fourth most liberal senator.
Right.
So the only thing, because I watch it at home and I'm stupid. How do they figure that?
We have votes and bills that we sponsor, and they track.
I'm not retarded. How do they compile?
They list them. You take a list.
But who's they?
These groups that I told you about.
But which one is the one that said they're the first and the fourth?
You take the trial lawyers or the people that follow the union votes and the people who follow the small business votes or the corporate votes,
right.
And they all go, you're either with us 100% of the time or 0% of the time, and they kind of average them all together.
Who?
These groups do.
But which one, when you say first most liberal and fourth most liberal, what is the group and how is it, because I'm not...
No, I hope I'm explaining it clearly.
That's very funny stuff. But this was a real interrogation. I mean, you were doing what journalists do there.
No, I think I actually was doing what journalists don't do. I think that's why I voted high. Isn't that the issue? The journalists don't do that. That basically, when you're, and I'm not talking about print, but isn't the issue that on television, those sorts of operatives for both political parties go on the air and say, John Kerry is the first most liberal, or the new jobs created are $9,000 less. And nobody ever says, I'm sorry, I don't mean to stop you, but what? What was that? Where do you come up with these numbers?
Right. But, I mean, do you feel yourself getting pulled into doing a job that journalists ought to be doing? I mean...
No. I don't, because I feel myself being pulled into areas that strike me as of interest to me. And that strikes me as an area of interest that so many of these you know, these political parties, it's very interesting, but they've, you know, they are basically dedicated to figuring out how to game the system. And they have found, I think, the real vulnerability in our media. And they are exploiting that loophole. And the vulnerability is twofold. One is the pace at which the 24-hour networks have, so it's sort of their deadline pressure. And the other is that the anchors are not versed in an expertise of news. They are TV people. And so those two together form sort of a conspiracy of a non-aggression pact, if you will. And it allows these talking point robots, operatives from different political parties, to go on these shows and basically lay it out there without question. And it's done to influence people through repetition.
So deceptive content never gets challenged. Nobody ever gets to the bottom of it.
I wouldn't say never, but the prevailing sense is that if it is challenged, it's in print and a week later when the information is available. And if I know it, it's clearly available. Because I'm not exactly, you know, I'm not like one of the old guys with a metal detector on the beach searching for, like, it's there on my computer Right. Pretty much when I boot it up.
Well, I guess what a producer of a talk show or Crossfire might say is, but, you know, in the great marketplace of ideas, our solution is to provide competition. The other side is always there. And if one side has phony talking points, the other side's right there. Doesn't that work?
Doesn't seem to be. I mean, but that's not... In the marketplace of ideas, from what I understand, there aren't only two products available. Mm-hmm. So if that's like saying, you know, fair competition is soda machines with only Coke and Pepsi in them. It's not the case that it is a free marketplace of ideas. And the other side of it is, what is the expertise of the anchor? What is your role then? That's like saying the referee for a football game is just there to make sure no one dies. You know, there are, should be... you know, truths, actual truths, and someone should be there to help arbitrate that. And it seems to be that media should be the forum for that. For instance, on Crossfire, I'm not sure what those guys are doing there other than egging their own side on. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I think that puts out misinformation or disinformation because it vouches for deception by allowing it on television. You are vouching for it. You're saying these people, we've done a background check. They're okay. It's like the Swift Boat veteran guys. They go right on TV.
Right. They're granted the credibility of wide access, right?
Absolutely. They're granted the credibility of, and it's not enough to bring someone on from the Democratic side, which, and say, well, actually, this isn't true. Someone has to earn some credibility here, don't they? And it's frustrating for me. You know, I watch these 24-hour news networks all day long. You know, it's because I night manage a Bennigan's, and I just happen to have it on.
But what a life!
It's really quite incredible. But in general, you know, I think it's they have abdicated their role. You know, politicians are doing, of course they're doing what they do. They're trying to get away with as much as they can get away. But what I'm saying is political parties are working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day to find the loopholes and vulnerabilities in the media system. And the media has to be better. The problem is the media isn't monolithic. We sort of keep talking about the media. And unfortunately, it's a series of these fiefdoms. And they have figured out how to play these fiefdoms off against each other. It's that competition. If you... question us on our talking points. Here's an example. I was watching during the Republican convention, Dick Cheney's daughter, and not the one that they hide, the other one, was on, I think it was Anderson Cooper's show. And she was doing the Republican talking points about John Kerry and the thing. And Anderson Cooper, to his credit, stopped her and said, well, you know, to be fair, you're sort of taking that out of context then. And literally, he interrupted twice, and she said, very angrily, what are you, a surrogate? And I thought, wow, is that where we've gotten? We've gotten to the point where if an anchor interrupts a talking point, you accuse them of being an operative, which, by the way, is also a strategy. to discredit the person that, that disagrees with you. The other example was Zell Miller went on a Hardball after his relatively insane rant that if you listen to without the picture reminded you very much of Strom Thurmond's famous 1948 speech, but not in content so much as delivery. Uh-huh. But so Chris Matthews questioned him on, you really think John Kerry would defend this country with spitballs? And Zell Miller was so upset at being questioned, he challenged Chris Matthews to a duel. Mm-hmm. Which is basically, you know, the idea is, if the news media questions my talking points, I will threaten to kill you. I mean, that's, you know, these politicians are so unaccustomed to interrupted spin that they literally lash out.
Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Water Room, a Bryant & May mystery set in London by Christopher Fowler, author of Full Dark House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Carole King has a new live album. She tells us about writing some of the greatest songs of the 60s and 70s. Also a review of the new film Hustle and Flow, and we'll continue our conversation with Daily Show host Jon Stewart. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to my 2004 interview with Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. The show's coverage of last year's presidential campaign, called Indecision 2004, has just been released on DVD. You grew up in Lawrenceville, New Jersey.
That is correct.
Were you a class clown? Did you have the sort of persona that made fun of everybody in a kind of playful and endearing way?
Yes, I was very playful and
that
endearing.
Was you.
I was an imp. I was on the smallish side, and yet my head is the size it is now. I looked like a Peanuts character, is what I'm trying to say, except with acne. You can imagine I was very popular.
Yeah, must have been a great effect.
I was always very proud in high school. I was voted best sense of humor and not class clown. And I always thought there was a very big distinction there, even though I'm not quite sure what it is. But I think that early on, yeah, people always say, you know, when did you realize you were funny? And I think it's not that you realize you were funny. It's that your brain works in a certain way. Hmm. And I don't think that that's, I think in some respects it's uncontrollable. And you can either accept it and deal with it and hone it, or you can try and fight it. And I was too weak to fight it. And so I just sort of went with it. And the big thing to learn was how to turn obnoxiousness into wit. And that was the hardest, probably, lesson. Obnoxiousness is what gets your butt kicked. And wit is what makes people go, oh, that's endearing. And it's trying not to get your butt kicked while still having your brain work in the way that you're comfortable with.
What do you mean by your brain works in a different way?
It, for some reason, defaults to a joke. I don't know why it does that. It certainly isn't helpful. It didn't help me keep any other job other than this one. But for some reason, it always looks to mischief. Mm-hmm. For instance, I didn't do any theater or anything like that when I was younger, but we did do one senior year in high school. We were in a play called The Pajama Game. And our first night performing it at the high school in front of a full crowd, and everybody took it very seriously, and rightfully so. My friends and I were in the chorus. We did Steam Heat, you know, very powerful version, I might add. Mm-hmm. But there's one scene at a picnic where the two lovers finally come together at the front of the stage, and they're alone on stage, and it's in front of a backdrop of trees. And as they were out there, just about to begin this beautiful duet, I wandered out and put my back to the audience and pretended I was relieving myself on one of the trees. Now, as you can imagine, the crowd found this somewhat amusing. The two actors on stage, not so much. The director of the play, again, sided with the actors, not so much. Me, I thought, oh my God, I'm killing. This is awesome. This play is going great. And this is what I'm suggesting to you, is that it's learning when to use it, how to use it, but by God, there's nothing else you can do. It's just some reason in any situation it occurs to you that wouldn't it be funny if, and that's that.
Right. You went to college, William and Mary, and right. I read that you were 23 when you had a job with the state of New Jersey, and you know, looking forward to a reasonably happy life with a car, and you know, making your way through the world, and you decided to go to New York and do stand up. And at first just got brutalized, as people do. And I'm wondering, you know, there are lots of people who are funny that make their friends laugh, make their family laugh. And then when they get on stage and try and make an audience laugh, it just doesn't work. What?
Yeah, that was me.
What is it? I mean, you were so funny. You had that brain working that way. What was it you didn't know?
What was it I didn't know about which?
About why didn't it work? Why is being funny with your friends not the same thing as...
Well, because it's a craft. You know, it isn't... There's a big difference between having an analytical mind and being a good scientist. There is a craft to learn. And that was the biggest lesson, is that it takes... Again, it's that idea of turning obnoxiousness into wit or comedy. You know, creating something from nothing is different from just being reactive at a bar. And you have to create the atmospheric conditions for comedy. Comedy is, oddly enough, very fragile and can be thrown off by, you know, a glass breaking or somebody talking, or, you know, there's a lot of different elements to it that, and construction of a joke, you know, you have to create. One of the things about being funny in life is the premise is already there.
Right.
Typically when you're with your friends, premises are coming up left and right. But when you're on stage, you must create the premise. So you have to create the premise, paint the picture, and then deliver the punchline. You have to take them from their, you know, sitting, you know, their lack of movement. You take them from zero to laughter, whereas in life, all that inertia is already presented, and you're just deflecting it. Being funny in life is a lot more like, you know, judo. It's using the energy that's coming at you to your advantage.
Right.
Doing stand-up comedy is in the middle of a traffic jam, getting everybody moving again. You know, it's a totally different skill and environment, and one that is learned.
Well, John Stewart, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
John Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. The show's coverage of last year's presidential campaign, called Indecision 2004, has just been released on DVD. Coming up, singing and songwriting legend Carole King. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Before Carole King had hits of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers. Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away. Doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago I reached for you and there you stood. Holding you again could only do me good. How I wish I could, but you're so far away.
Carole King wrote that for her 1971 album, Tapestry, that remained on the charts for 6 years. She performs it on her new CD, The Living Room Tour, a collection of new songs and classics. She's currently on a summer tour to a number of cities around the country. When Carole King first started writing professionally, she worked with Jerry Goffin at a New York publishing company owned by Don Kirshner. Kirshner is the rock producer who hosted late-night rock concerts on TV and produced The Monkees. When Terry spoke with Carole King in 1989, she asked if it was strange to be turning out songs in a cubicle in a Manhattan office building.
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home, sometimes easier because, we had the kids at home. But also, in the office building, just as often, we'd have one of the kids in the room. One of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had 3 albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters banging out new tunes?
It's by now, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and say Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments?
Always.
Like, what would an assignment be like?
The Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit and we want to get the next one. Donnie Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. You know, he was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donnie. He just, He just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, you know, the melody, the lyrics,
right,
and everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records, because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was in fact a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, you know, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But you know, I always liked the fact that they were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter, because it was happening.
When you were working with other groups writing songs for them in the 60s, did you usually meet them, the singers and groups that you were writing for?
Not always, but generally, yeah, because we, even if we weren't involved in the production, we'd often go to the sessions. We did.
What would you do if you felt that a singer or a group wasn't putting your song over right?
I don't think it ever happened.
Really?
I imagine if it did, you know, not being shy about communicating my feelings about those kind of things, I probably found a way to let somebody know or make a suggestion, but I don't know. Usually they picked up the energy from the demo, and if anything, took it, you know, way farther. One of the great moments of my life as a songwriter was the first time that I heard Aretha Franklin's version of Natural Woman, which was in many ways not like the demo at all. It was amazing, because this was the ultimate singer in the world to me. And she was singing my song, and she had taken what I did with it and did what I never dreamed could be done with it.
And so you were thrilled. Did you for a moment feel like it was no longer your song or something?
Oh, no, okay. Not at all. Uh-huh. It was my song taken to the nth power.
How did you feel recording that song after she did it?
I felt that, you know, the idea of topping it didn't even cross my mind, but I felt that as the songwriter, I had sort of a claim on any version of it I wanted to do, and it would be okay because I wrote it. When I say I, Jerry Goffin also co-wrote that. But it wasn't even a problem in my mind. It was like two very separate things. Nobody could even approach how she sang it, so that wasn't even in my mind.
I think your first really big hit, your first number one hit, was a song you wrote for the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. What were you keeping in mind when you wrote that song for them, one of the first girl groups?
Well, again, Jerry wrote that lyric. Jerry has written, being a man, he has written some of the best lyrics for women that exist, Natural Woman being one of them, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, another one, and one I didn't write with him, Saving All My Love for You by Whitney Houston. I think he was thinking, he did what I was talking about. He put himself in the mental persona of what it would be like to be a young girl, thinking, yeah, but will you respect me in the morning? And as far as the music went, I had in my mind their previous hit, which was Tonight's the Night, and we always kind of tried to incorporate some of the chordal feeling and the mood and the energy, and just kind of write it backwards, upside down, and sideways, and the combination just worked. Also, when I was growing up, I listened to classical music a lot, as well as Broadway. I had a real good background in all kinds of music, real good exposure, and so I think there's almost a classical feel to that melody and the arrangement with the cellos starting it off.
Mm-hmm. Was it a crisis for you when bands started writing their own songs? I know a lot of songwriters felt shut out in the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, I think that was a problem for us for a while. I think the bigger problem, because there were still people looking for material, but the biggest problem when Bob Dylan and the Beatles came along was not so much that they were self-contained, but that they were so good. They were so raw and so different from, we were a little more polished by that time, having had all our training and, you know, our types of exposure to Broadway and pop music, and these guys were like, you know, out there, raw. So it took us a while to figure out what it is they were doing.
And once you figured out what it is they were doing, did it change your songwriting?
Probably, but I couldn't to this day tell you how.
Mm-hmm. After you and Jerry Goffin broke up, you started writing lyrics to your own songs, and you also started performing. What was it that got you in front of the microphone on stage and in the recording studio?
I don't know. I do know that it seemed inevitable. I did a record called Now That Everything's Been Said with a group called The City, which consisted of Charlie Larkey, my bass player and also second husband, and Danny Korchmar, who is, you know, now a well-known guitar player and producer and writer in his own right. And they just kept egging me on, come on, you can do it. And we never did go on the road with The City. We had we used Jimmy Gordon as a drummer on the record, but we just never did go on the road. But then I met James Taylor and started playing as a backup musician for him. And so I'd find myself on a stage with him. And one night he said, well, why don't you, you know, do one of your songs? And I was terrified. He said, no, it'll be fine. And in the middle of his set, he introduced me to his audience as the woman that had written a lot of their favorite hits. And he was going to turn the stage over to me, and we were good friends and all. And the audience, who loved him, was sort of ready to receive me and pre-liked me. So it was like, well, okay, they're ready to like me. I guess I'll do this. And it just was real easy. I really learned from James that all you have to do is get out there and be yourself and do the song and, you know, it's okay. It's just the same as playing it for a few friends in a living room as it is for 20,000 people.
No, I would imagine that writing songs for so many years and seeing all these great groups and singers record them, that you'd get kind of envious and sometimes wish that it were you on that stage or selling all those records with your voice on it. You never felt envious of them?
I don't know if envious is the right word. Just at a certain point, writing the songs was the main thing. To write the song, to look at this thing and say, I did that, was great. And then getting on stage for me became less of a thing about glamour and glory, which I was actually more uncomfortable with than anything, the glamour and the glory. But it was the concept of, I guess I'm the best person to present my song, or I'm the only person to present my song at this time, or whatever. It just seemed like a way of presenting the song, but to me it was always about the song.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Carole King.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
Carole King speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Her new CD is called The Living Room Tour. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film Hustle and Flow. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. The writer and director John Singleton invested $3 million of his own money to make Craig Brewer's first feature, Hustle and Flow, after every studio passed on the project. Singleton made his money back and then some when the film sold for $9 million at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Hustle and Flow is the gritty yet heartwarming story of an abusive pimp, DJ, played by Terrence Howard, who has a midlife crisis and decides to turn his life around by realizing his long-buried dream of making music. See, the pimp stuff is his hustle, but the music, that's his flow. DJ bumps into an old friend, Key, played by Anthony Anderson, who works as a sound engineer, mostly for church choirs. Here he makes a pitch for Key's help.
Look, man, I know you done learned the whole mess of hustling out on the street, right? Let me tell you what I learned while working on my job.
Thank you.
There are two types of people. Those that talk the talk and those that walk the walk. People who walk the walk, they sometimes talk the talk. But most of the time, they don't talk at all because they walk. Now, people who talk the talk, when it comes time for them to walk, you want to know what they do?
What's that?
They talk people like me into walking for them.
Look, I'm just asking you. Just listen to what I got here, man. All right? Just listen to it. And if you ain't feeling it, man, I'm out your life, okay?
You get a sense of how mesmerizing Howard is just from his voice. He's an actor and musician, probably best known for his role in the recent Crash as an African-American TV director who downplays his blackness to fit into white Hollywood. Here he plays black with a vengeance. He has some of Samuel L. Jackson's intensity, but Hustle and Flow is set in Memphis, and Howard's sound isn't hard or staccato. It's lighter, higher, more caressing, a mixture of tense and easy. He could almost be speaking verse. Then he is speaking verse. In his makeshift studio, DJ scrawls down some lyrics and begins to rap for Key. But they still need to nail down a refrain. Something DJ says along the lines of, punch that hoe, or beat that bitch.
Go back.
What?
Whoop that trick.
That's it.
Like what?
Like a chant, man. Whoop that trick.
Whoop that trick.
Get him. Whoop that trick. Get him. Whoop that trick. Get him. Whoop that trick. Get him. Whoop that trick.
Hey, keep
getting
in.
Whoop that trick. Get him. Whoop that trick. Get him. Whoop that.
DJ needs a woman singer. And as luck would have it, his main lady, Shug, played by Tara G. P. Henson, has a good voice. She's very pregnant and not generating any income at the moment, and it's hard to say no to DJ, who can get physical.
You know it's hard out here for a pimp.
Shug, I'm gonna need you to sing out, okay, baby?
Okay.
Shug, feel that.
You know it's hard out here for a pimp. When he trying to get this money for the rent.
Push that out. Come on.
You know it's hard out here for a pimp. When he trying to get this money for the rent. For the Cadillacs and gas money spent. You know it's hard out here for a pimp. When he trying to get this money for the rent. For the Cadillacs and gas money spent.
That's it right there. That's the money tank. You got that?
Yeah, hold on. We're going to see in a minute.
I'm saying it, man.
A large part of the legend of Hustle and Flow is its electric reception at the 2005 Sundance Film Festival. Standing ovation, $9 million advance from Paramount and MTV Films. You can picture all those white executives in their furs and parkas pouring out into the frigid Utah night chanting, whoop that trick, whoop that trick. Apart from the idea that a pimp can be an artist, that's got to resonate in Hollywood, there is something genuinely compelling about this movie. The first-time director and writer, Craig Brewer, gets the hustle and flow into the filmmaking. The camera work is handheld and swervy and dangerously in the moment, so you get knotted up as DJ approaches every hurdle. You feel that his very existence is always on the line. The movie builds to an almost unbearable sequence in which DJ takes a CD of Whoop That Trick to a hip-hop star known as Skinny Black, played by the hip-hop star known as Ludacris. Skinny's back in his Memphis hometown for only a night, and DJ must go for broke and make this man understand the depth of his soul and of his music. Hustle and Flow is quite a trick, yes siree. It's tough to believe that a director could get a modern audience to identify with a hero who makes art out of complaining about his whores being late with the rent. When DJ needs a high-end microphone, he turns to a pretty little blonde white hooker named Nola, played by Tamron Manning, to prevail upon the salesman for a better deal. Brewer didn't need that scene. He could have found ways to sweeten DJ or make Nola feel less violated, but then the movie wouldn't have the edge that fools an audience into thinking it's seeing unmediated realism instead of the usual inspirational rags-to-riches cliches. The flouting of political correctness is part of the hustle. There's no proof that Brewer doesn't share his character's misogyny and opportunism. He sticks his camera under Manning's little skirt the way DJ would if he'd been directing. But you know, it's hard out there for a director.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Pettis Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of poison and its victims, from Beethoven to the recently elected president of the Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko. We talk with John Emsley about the intentional and accidental uses of lethal compounds through the ages. His new book is The Elements of Murder. Join us for the next Fresh Air.